Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 28th of September. North Korea is our focus the first hour of the program today. There were several military promotions on Tuesday of this week that rearranged the future leadership of North Korea. The youngest son and sister of Kim Jong-il became four-star generals, and we're going to be joined this hour by Han Park, who's a university professor of international affairs and director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia, to talk about what this means and to give us insight as to what's going on in that incredibly secretive and very strange country. Professor Park has visited the Democratic People's Republic of Korea quite often in his efforts to resolve the nuclear crisis that developed there in the early 90s. He has gone to North Korea more than 40 times since 1981, and there may not be anybody in this country or perhaps in the world who's visited the country that often. When former President Carter made a visit in North Korea in 1994, Professor Park secured his invitation from the North Korean government and briefed him prior to his departure. He has made numerous trips, as I said, to North Korea to persuade government officials to improve relations with the United States by inviting President Clinton at the end of his presidency. And the effort culminated in Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's landmark visit to Pyongyang in the year 2000. He has written extensively about issues here. He is the founding president of Uniting Families, a nonprofit humanitarian organization reuniting hundreds of separated family members in China and in the Koreas. He is with us this hour of the program, and we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Han Park, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Tell me what these military promotions meant. Does this indeed mean that the youngest son and the sister of Kim Jong-il will become the principal leaders of North Korea?
Absolutely. The fact that Kim Jong-un is going to be the successor has been a secret, but everyone knew in North Korea. Now more publicly and officially, his position has been promoted to, I think he got a position as vice chairman of the Korea Workers' Party's military commission, the chairman being his father. This symbolically suggests that he is next in line. What is important that needs to be looked at much more carefully is the advancement of Kim Jong-hee, Kim Jong-il, current leader's younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
They have a common mother, Kim Il-sung's first wife, who is heralded in North Korea as just like her husband, as one of the leading figures against the Japanese colonial rule. So I think, I believe North Korea is now de facto dynasty surrounding Kim Il-sung's family. So Kim Jong-hee's advancement may suggest that it is a really more dynastic arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And Kim Jong-hee herself, she's a senior person with a lot of experience, so will have a lot of role, especially in view of the age of Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this, these appointments and the meeting just concluded. I think the meeting lasted only for one day, which is very unusually short, but a very important landmark in North Korean political dynamics.
Kim Jong-il evidently has three sons. Why did he choose this youngest son?
The first son has too many baggages, so to speak. He has been known as a women chaser and flamboyant person, never restraining from speaking out anything and everything he wants. And he has been traveling Macau and Europe all over. So he's not respected very well given the Oriental kind of Confucian culture. And a future leader must be groomed in secrecy with a lot of mystique. So Kim Jong-nam, who is the first son, is disqualified for his personality reasons. And second son is a reportedly very feminine person. It's going to be hard for the system to promote him as a military commander and so forth. But the third son, the picture will soon be revealed, the current picture. I visited North Korea in July this month. I was able to see the real picture that never publicized. This third son looks just like his grandfather.
Oh, my.
And very handsome, very calm and composed. So I think he has been chosen by the Kim family for some years now.
He's also very young. Can you imagine how old he would have to be in order to be considered a leader?
Yeah, it's going to be some problem there. When Kim Jong-il succeeded his father, actually in 1980, Kim Jong-il was designated de facto successor of Kim Il-sung. He was 38 years old. And Kim Jong-un is much too young, maybe 27, maybe 28. But everything hinges on how long Kim Jong-il may live. And there are a lot of speculations about his failing health. But when I was in Pyongyang just a few months ago, he was physically quite vigorous. He was going to various locations throughout the country. They have a program called on-the-spot inspection or guidance tours. So Kim Jong-il was performing that tour at the rate of every 3 days he would go someplace. So the North Koreans don't seem to be concerned about the health of Kim Jong-il. But he is not going to live very long, it seems to me. I don't think he is urgent and imminent. His passing away, it appeared to be imminent, anything like that. But I think it may give maybe a few years, two, 3 years, and that's the time that Kim Jong-un may be groomed together with Kim Jong-il's sister.
I see.
Yeah, so it's a kind of family kind of a time. We are witnessing the emergence of a dynasty.
Hmm. Tell me about your profound interest in this country. You have been there perhaps more times than anybody on this planet. Why?
I was born in China during the later years of the Chinese Civil War. I witnessed the horrors of military confrontation, and I came down to Korea, then undivided Korea, but only to find myself in the midst of the Korean War, again, bloody war. And knowing the military preparedness on the part of both North and South, another military skirmish would mean annihilation of the Korean people, perhaps millions of people. So I kind of wanted to being here in the United States as an American citizen, and a scholar here, I was able to travel a little more freely. I came from South Korea, but with this position, I was able to go and talk to them and in any way possible alleviate tension between Washington and Pyongyang, thereby a military confrontation may be preempted.
And you have been able to alleviate a great deal of tension. You have been extremely instrumental in, well, in most recently negotiating for the release of two American citizens who crossed the border to do a news story about North Korea. You were instrumental in having Madeleine Albright be there, President Clinton, President Carter. You've done some big-time negotiating, sir.
It's not official. It's unofficially. Actually, by and large, voluntarily, although I have been in contact with these, some of these people that you mentioned prior to and after my activities. But North Koreans basically developed a gradual, I guess, trust and confidence in me as a person who they can trust, not as a ideological companion or comrade or anything like that, but as a friend. I have tried to keep my promises. I have never given any promise that I could not carry on. So it's a long, 1981 is a long time ago. I was a young assistant professor here in the United States. So, for a long period of time, I have shown my sincerity in helping them in any way possible economically. For example, as we speak, I don't know how public it can go out at this point. I have been instrumental in arranging the building of homes by U.S. Christian kind of entity. It's a offspring of the Habitat for
yes.
Humanity,
mm-hmm.
Fuller Center for Housing, and I brought them into North Korea several times. So finally, groundbreaking was completed, and they're going to go in. The U.S. volunteers will go in and join with the North Korean workers and build the homes there. Home building is important, but to me, more importantly, through this project, people-to-people contact may develop. Knowing both systems, the peoples, the United States and North Korea, both are decent. North Korean people may be a victim of misguided policies and wrong kind of political system, but if you actually examine the system itself. We all are individuals, and systems are the products of our environment. If you examine North Korean political system in geopolitical context, in terms of political history, and the fact that they have been under a very severe pressure to do something about national defense, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union and Communist bloc, and the presence of economically, militarily superior South Korea across the border, you know, that they have had to develop something. That something has been, unfortunately, the nuclear program and nuclear weapon. They succeeded in doing that. So North Korea has become North Korea, and we're talking about North Korea because North Korea has a nuclear weapons. Without nuclear weapons, North Koreans think that nuclear weapons program and their nuclear capacity would make them a herd in the international community. It advances their self-esteem. So it's in other words, it's a very complicated political system, but the fact of the matter is North Korea and the Korean Peninsula is quite vulnerable to political and military confrontation. So we have to pay attention to do something, anything possible to alleviate the potential tension and preempt military confrontation.
Tell me, Professor Park, about the amount of money that went into development of nuclear weapons and how it probably was done at the expense of many, many other programs that would make lives a little bit easier for people who live there.
It is not the nuclear program that is costly. It is the conventional weaponry, making tanks and airplanes and so forth, missiles, and these are expensive. But nuclear programs itself might be financially most rational choice. But North Korea is also heavily armed country, conventional weapons as well. So, yes, the military expenditure has been a major reason for North Korea's economic difficulty.
We have a number of people who would like to speak with you, so we'll go to phone calls. Dr. Han Park is University Professor of International Affairs and Director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia. He was born in China to immigrant Korean parents and received his education in China, Korea, and the United States. He has visited North Korea maybe more often than anybody on the planet right now and has done some behind-the-scenes phenomenal negotiating. We just have touched on a couple of the things that he's accomplished. Our conversation prompted today because of a series of military promotions. Kim Jong-un, the youngest of Kim Jong-il's three sons, was made a four-star general, as was his aunt, Kim Jong-il's sister, Kim Jong-wi, and we're talking about what that means and the political dynasty being built in North Korea, and eventually we'll talk about what that means for the world. Let's go to your phone calls, starting with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Howdy, Kathleen and Professor Park. Just within the last 2 days, I saw former President Jimmy Carter on the Charlie Rhodes Show, he's in the hospital now, so this must have been pre-recorded. I have a rather sweeping question to ask you. I was rather surprised that what we began to believe the North Koreans wanted back in the early 90s, he says, is still operational. And you obviously understand this situation a lot better than I do. Could you summarize or characterize what Jimmy Carter has been saying that the North Koreans want and how far they're willing to go, and also critique what he says about our own Washington politicians and how they're sort of stymieing any agreement any change in the North Korean behavior?
Yes. First of all, President Carter, I respect immensely. I spoke with him before his most recent trip, and I had knowledge about his orientations and inclinations and policy preferences for the United States. But in specifics, it's only Jimmy Carter himself who will say. But my understanding of his position and the substantive discussion that he had with North Korean top leadership was that we need to have a direct dialogue with North Korea. And they found out this is actually the case. North Koreans' top foreign policy objective is to improve relations with the United States. It is a very rational thinking, and that is without improving relations with the United States, the security environment there would be still very, very untenable. With that environment, foreign investors will stay away. So without that now in global market system, they don't have the capital, they don't have the technology for consumer goods. So here, the North Koreans' desire to have better relationship with Washington is real and sincere. That's what President Carter conveyed, I think, in his writings and in his reports after the trip. And also, former President Carter's criticism of current U.S. policy toward North Korea is that President Obama promised that he will open up direct dialogue with all adversarial forces in the world in his campaign. And after 20 months in his presidency, we are yet to see the direct kind of dialogue apart from six-party talks. So President Carter believes that we need to listen to North Koreans as well, without alleviating their concern for their own national security. They're not going to relinquish their nuclear preparedness. I agree with that assessment. So we've got to do something about the security condition in the Korean Peninsula. For that, we have to improve relations between us and North Korea. That will include immediately the current armistice agreement that was signed in 1953 is obsolete. We have to replace that with more meaningful and realistic enduring arrangement, that is, peace agreement or peace treaty. I think that's what President Jimmy Carter would like to see. So basically, it's the eventual goal is peace building in that peninsula, that country. The Korean Peninsula, as we all know, is arguably the most heavily militarily fortified spot in the entire world. This kind of discussion is quite useful to draw attention to the flashpoint in the peninsula.
More phone calls in a moment. Professor Han Park is our guest. We're talking about North Korea and the future leadership of that country this hour of the program and more. Our number is 800-486-8655. Carl, thanks for your call. More in a moment. The email, and we're getting several of those as well, is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen and Dr. Park. I just finished the book recently, Nothing to Envy, The Ordinary Lives of North Koreans. And the book portrays the desperate economic conditions of the people in North Korea. And I'm wondering if things have improved any. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Eugene, thanks.
The economic condition on the ground, no one knows exactly. I think I have a general feeling about that, perhaps a more realistic, better than a lot of people. I have traveled North Korea each and every year since 1991, first being 81. But for the last 12 years or so, without skipping a year, I have traveled to North Korea, and I've seen over time changes. The food situation, for example, is quite serious, but not as bad as it was in 1990s, mid-90s, but serious. Basically, the South Korean shipment of food was suspended with the emergence of this Lee Myung-bak government in the South. But to replace that, perhaps, there have been assistance of various nature from China. So I think North Korea has decided to adopt the China model for their economic development. That is, try to maintain political centralism combined with selected policies, from free market competition. They will try to establish as many special economic zones to induce foreign capital and technology. They have a huge pool of a very good labor force and considerable underground resources. So they are planning to have all these. But the problem is the defense situation, national security situation. So that's why, as I mentioned a moment ago, they're trying to improve relations with the United States. But on the ground, it seems to me, mass starvations are not occurring at this time because of a shortage of electricity. Some 80% of North Korean electricity is coming from China. So China is so important, as symbolically indicated by two recent trips by Kim Jong-il himself. So the situation is bad, but not as bad as some time ago. And they have their own plans and some strategies, mostly dealing with China, and try to diversify the economic foreign policy. And I think fair amount of efforts are going into the Nordic countries in Europe, as well as the Western Europe.
What are their underground resources?
They have zinc, for example. Arguably, the more reserved than anywhere. Magnesium. They have a fair amount. Even they might have a good reserve of petroleum, oil, underground. Some companies, especially from Europe, Italian and French and England companies, came in and did some survey. They concluded, according to sources provided by North Korean government to me, the Western companies concluded that North Korea East Coast and West Coast, especially East Coast, deep sea oil reserve is a fairly large quantity. So North Korea in government, they have a department of oil when they don't produce any oil. They actually have a department oil. So their long-term, their scheme, their strategy is there. But currently, mostly because of Western and South Korean economic blockade, North Korea is suffering a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that North Korea is not to blame. North Korea has failed the policies, domestic as well as international.
We go to Scott in La Crosse next. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Yet another great guest and fascinating program. Thank you.
Thank you.
My question involves the nuclear scenario. One of the things we are repeatedly told is that one main reason that nobody wants to see Iran get nuclear weapons is because it would touch off an arms race in that part of in that region. In other words, the Saudis and the Syrians, et cetera, would all be scrambling to get nuclear weapons. My question is, what about the North Koreans? Is there the fact that they have nuclear weapons? Obviously, China does, but is there now any kind of a move in South Korea and Japan, obviously their nearest neighbors, to go nuclear? And if not, why not?
I think that's a very good question. One important reason that we have to insist on North Korea's denuclearization is exactly that, potential nuclear proliferation. if North Korea is allowed to continue with the arming with the nuclear arsenal, then Japan will be the first country to be alarmed, perhaps do away with their Constitution Article 9, which prohibits North Korean Japan's armament. And then if Japan decided to go to nuclear, it has the technology, it has the money. So it will take maybe only months rather than years for Japan to become quite a legitimate nuclear force in the region. And that will agitate China. We all know Sino-Japanese relationship has always been unstable. There has been enormous amount of animosity between the two systems. We are looking at the situation today between that. So the situation. So I think the North Korean denuclearization will mean preempting regional denuclearization. Nuclearization. South Korea has the ability, technology, as well as resources. Taiwan has that. So it will be a madhouse in that part of the world. So North Korean denuclearization is very essential to essential to global denuclearization.
And who is most capable of helping North Korea move in that direction?
North Koreans themselves. North Koreans themselves. They will not denuclearize as long as they feel that their security is in a very bad situation, which they think it is. Even China, we speculate China will have upper hand in influencing North Korean policy, which is not the case. First of all, China may not be inclined to exert its will on North Korea. But more importantly, North Korea is not going to listen even to the Chinese when it comes to jeopardizing their security situation. So we've got to induce North Korea into thinking that their security environment has improved. And that's when we have to realistically talk to North Koreans, expect from North Korea to do something about denuclearization.
We go. Thanks, Scott, for your call. Charles in Ingleside, Illinois. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. I have a question that's bothered me for some time. I talked with Robert Warney, who with the State Department team that negotiated to end the Korean atomic program, and he had photographs showing that they got far enough to actually burn one of the reactors. Now, after achieving that, what happened to reverse our progress with them to end that atomic program? I have a weak signal. I'd like to take the response off the air. Please.
All right. Thank you, Charles.
I didn't get the gist of the question.
He spoke with somebody in the State Department, and North Korea had burned one of its reactors. What kept them from carrying on?
Yeah. I don't know. One of the reactors, I think a couple of years ago, they destroyed a cooling tower.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was what is being referred to. They did that as a part of agreement with the IAEA and the United States in the middle of that. As I said, I think they are genuinely interested in getting away from nuclear weapons. In fact, it is not terribly well known outside North Korea. North Korea is Kim Il-sung. That's the person who died some 15 years ago. Kim Il-sung's country. And right now, Kim Jong-un and his father, Kim Jong-il, these were legitimized in the name of Kim Il-sung. So Kim Il-sung, you know, even today, Kim Il-sung's directives, his teachings are very clearly and strictly adhered to. In North Korea, in every office, you will have a daily calendar. You flip over the calendar to that particular day. You have numerous directives issued by Kim Il-sung a long time ago. So in this situation, Kim Il-sung's words are important. Now, with this background, North Koreans are reminding me and everyone there that Kim Il-sung wanted to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. He never wanted the nuclear weapons on the soil of Korea. So people are thinking of that. And also, if you have a regional arms race, nuclear arms race, as a result of North Korea's maintaining the weapons program, North Korea will lag behind because it doesn't have the economic foundation to support further militarization behind China, behind the South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. So North Korea wants to so-called bargain it away at this time when they cash in the most. So they are prepared to give away their weapons if the price is right, so to speak.
Right. Here's an email from Larry in Oshkosh. How does the North Korean government explain its family dynasty to its people, given its supposedly Marxist ideology?
North Korea is not a Marxist country. It has not been a Marxist country for a long time. Just like Mao's China, Mao Zedong's China, was not consistent with Stalin, Leninist, or Marxist doctrine. Mao developed the Chinese version of socialism. Just like that, North Korea is for decades now, it's a paternalistic system. It's dynasty of sorts. Now, clearly, third generation, three generations succession, clearly suggests that we have a dynasty in North Korea. How they persuade their people? It's very simple. You have to realize that North Korea has never experienced a political system, a republic political system, where people elect their leadership directly. This, 40 years of Japanese occupation, preceding that, we had centuries of Oriental Asian dynasties. And after Japanese occupation, Kim Il-sung took over. So the dynasties ended with the Yi dynasty. After Yi dynasty, I would say now we have a Kim dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of political culture, people's perception, that are alien to what we know here in the West. It's not very hard to persuade them. They believe that, some families are destined to rule. And in fact, a little remnant of that found in, for example, Meiji Japan. Even today, we have emperorship, although without much power. We have that one in UK, for example.
Right, yeah.
It's so symbolic, except in North Korean case, symbolism is really combined with the power.
More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking this hour about North Korea and the announcement on Tuesday of this week that Kim Jong-il's youngest son was made a four-star general, as was Kim Jong-il's sister, Kim Jong-wi. And we're talking about what that means, the continuation. Well, how many generations does it take for it to be a dynasty? But you've got three generations now, so the political dynasty. And we're looking at many other issues. Professor Park is quite a guy. He's visited the Democratic People's Republic of Korea many, many times. And he has been very instrumental behind the scenes in bringing former President Carter to North Korea. He secured Carter's invitation from the North Korea government and briefed him prior to his departure. He did work in recently, actually, maybe some of you saw these broadcasts with the North Korean government to permit ABC to broadcast live via satellite on several occasions. He also got Nicholas Kristof to write a series of articles for The Times. He has done a great deal of humanitarian work, and he consistently works to provide information to the public regarding contemporary world affairs, especially the North Korean nuclear crisis. Here's our phone number. We've had a lot of lines busy, but we do have a couple lines open now. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address, talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. October 21st, we're going to be doing a live broadcast from the beautiful Milwaukee Art Museum with Nancy Pearl, our wonderful librarian, and also with Lori Winters, who's director of exhibits at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And we're inviting you to be a part of the audience. It is a beautiful location, and they're superb guests. We're talking about books and art, and we'll have a reception following with some goodies. So we're asking if you'd like to attend, and we hope you will, that you send Rhonda an email. Her address is Fanning, F-A-N-N-I-N-G, at WPR.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and indicate that you would like to be a part of the event. It should be great. Back to phone calls now. Let's go to Bob is next from Clay Banks. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having the guest today.
Uh-huh.
I was curious about the guest's opinion on, I think he's a barbecue restaurant owner in New Jersey who's done a fair amount of diplomacy as a private citizen. And I wondered what he thought about his activities and if there's any other private citizens that he knows that are trying to help out with this with the situation with North Korea.
He's a barbecue? I don't know about this gentleman.
He wrote a book, and he was on NPR or maybe WPR within the last month or two, and talking about how he's had some dealings with the State Department and with the FBI, but has kind of chosen to go on his own so he doesn't threaten his connections with the folks.
Oh, and I guess it was on our show. I wasn't here. John Munson was filling in. Eating with the Enemy was the name of the book. That sounds
right.
Interesting. Yeah, I should read that. Professor Park?
I really do not know personally about this this story. I read, I think it's New Yorker or somewhere, and numerous other outlets. And I think this kind of thing is very important. Even if you are a critic of North Korea, I think it's important to talk about North Korea, to reveal correctly or incorrectly the North Korean situation. I think we should, in view of the fact that we have not official relations, and it's very difficult to expect government officials to do anything because foreign policy is much more complicated, but private citizens and NGOs should go into North Korea. In fact, future investors, North Korea could be a very attractive place once the political barriers are removed. Then it's a quite good investment location to do business with North Korea. You've got to have a personal ties, and more so than in China. In China too, and it's not legally governed kind of interaction. It's more personal touch is important. So maintaining and establishing relationship with North Korean people, especially people who have some influence in policy making, will get you a long way. By way of investment and maintaining, association in the future. So to the extent possible, and I think we should encourage American citizens to go to North Korea invite North Koreans in any capacity so that people-to-people interaction will be quite important, especially in view of grassroots communication media that we have, email and Facebook and so forth.
Thank you, Bob, so much. Let's go to John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm enjoying your program. I just returned as a tourist from North Korea last week.
Oh.
And my big question is, how does North Korea finance their economy since they have no taxes or any significant exports?
Yes. They have no taxes, but they have government-owned enterprises, businesses. Basically, they don't collect tax because they own, the government owns everything. So it's an entirely different kind of situation. There is no private ownership or private enterprises. It's quite limited. If there is some remnants of capitalism, it's practically not observable. You may have seen in Pyongyang, most recent. In fact, you visited there more recently than I. I was there in July. But I know the North Korean situation behind the scene. You see in the street all these street vendors selling some food and small things. Most of them are not operated by private individuals. They're operated by government agencies and so forth. Those agencies are required to generate their revenues because the central government doesn't have the money. And of late, we heard about all these drug smuggling, you know, all the cigarette and counterfeits and all that. It's not really central government planning. It's more regional government agencies, embassies, and so forth. They are forced to generate revenues. So it's a kind of that situation. So if you put that, you will know why North Korean government still operates without collecting taxes.
Thank you, John. Karen in Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi.
Good morning, Kamsahamnida, Professor. This is such a wonderful program. I feel as if I've had a course in modern Asian politics and history this morning.
Great.
Thank you.
I lived in Korea in the late 1960s for a year, and at the time in South Korea, and at the time, I just felt very strongly from Korean friends the desire to ease relations with North Korea. They wanted to see family members. They wanted to be able to travel back and forth. I'm wondering if you see any lightening of the conflict between North and South Korea, and the possibility of some of the easing of the problems they've had with each other.
I think that, as you may know, much of the last 10, 12 years before the arrival of current government, for some 10 years, there was quite extensive interaction. And they even had a couple of summit meetings, agreed to develop kind of unify the government in the form of confederacy. All these they did. But the problem is, again, the security environment. We have some 30,000, maybe 27 by now, United States ground troops there. We have every year, several times, we have joint military exercises. I think currently it's going on. When you have these things, North Koreans cannot be normal. So all the international, why do we have American troops there? Why do we have a military exercise? All these are very complicated situation. But the desire on the part of Korean people for reunification is real and very high, especially in North Korea. It's even higher. It's the government and international politics. Korea got divided by and large because of international political situation rather than Korean people themselves. So the unification of Korea will take more than the shared desire on the part of Korean people. It may take some international collaboration and cooperation.
I had no idea we still had that many troops there. 37,000.
Yes.
Wow.
I think 20. At one point, much of the time, we maintained that level of 35,000 U.S. ground troops. Now it's dwindled down to 27,000. So we have quite a people there.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry we're out of time. You're just fascinating and so informative. Thank you very much, Professor Park, for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, we'd love to call you again. Professor Han Park, University Professor of International Affairs, Director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia. Thanks, Chrissy Pease, for producing the hour and for on-air production here in Milwaukee.